Mother's Day is this Sunday, and ProFlowers is offering an amazing Mother's Day special. A beautiful bouquet of 24 assorted Mother's Day roses with a free glass vase, plus a free box of chocolates, all for just $29.99. Just visit ProFlowers.com, click on the microphone in the upper right corner, and enter the secret code HURRY. These 24 Mother's Day roses are bursting with color. They're the perfect way to show all the moms in your life how much you appreciate them. 24 assorted roses guaranteed to stay beautiful for at least 7 full days, plus a free glass vase and a free box of chocolates, all for just $29.99. But hurry, this special offer ends Friday. Mother's Day is this Sunday, and it's your last chance to take care of mom. The only way to get your last chance Mother's Day offer is to visit ProFlowers.com. Click on the microphone in the upper right corner and enter the secret code HURRY. Go to ProFlowers.com, secret code HURRY. That's ProFlowers.com, code HURRY.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. Kicking off our 2011 Mother's Day series, my guest for this morning is Jacqueline Elderberg. She is a mother and co-author of the book titled How to Walk to School. This is a true story about two moms who galvanized and organized an entire community to take a leap of faith, transforming a challenged urban school into one of Chicago's best virtually overnight by creating the blueprint for a neighborhood school renaissance. Jacqueline and I will be discussing about her life's journey and her work that has inspired other communities and their public school systems. Good morning, Jacqueline. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me on, Johnny. So appreciate it.
I am so excited to have you on. I believe in what you guys are doing up in Chicago, and you have a wonderful story to share with us, so I'm very, very excited to have you on this morning. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
From childhood to the present moment.
We have 4 hours now, Jacqueline, so we want all the good stuff.
That's so funny. Well, I have two children. They're right now they're 10 and 12. But I have a background in political science. I have a PhD from the University of Chicago. But when my daughter was born, she was premature, and she was just 3'11". And so I decided to leave academia for a little bit and really focus on feeding this girl and fattening her up. So I didn't totally anticipate being a stay-at-home mom, but it certainly is what happened part at the beginning out of necessity, but then because I realized that this was a chapter that I really didn't want to miss. So the short story of how we started this project is my husband, my ex-husband, was supposed to do all of the research on schools, and then he came to me and he told me he was too busy at work and that I was going to have to do all of that. And, you know, in Chicago, like many, many, many cities across the country, that is a really, really big project. Mm-hmm. And my daughter was 2.5 at the time, and I was pregnant with my second. And he said, well, you're not working right now. Go make yourself useful. Go figure it out. So my girlfriend in the park and I decided to check out Nettlehurst, which was our neighborhood school, and see just how terrible this place was before we panicked or went down that public-private magnet school path. In Chicago, it is really, really difficult to get your kid into a private school, and then if you can, good luck being able to afford it. Mm-hmm. And trying to get your kid into an established magnet school, a respected magnet school that's by lottery, it's statistically easier to get your high school senior into Harvard than it is to get into one of Chicago's premier magnet schools. So faced with that, we decided to go into our neighborhood school where no one we knew had ever been inside. I mean, it was just not a suitable option if you had other options. And the principal at the time, Susan Curlin, showed us around for 3 hours, and she said, what do I have to do to get your kids to come to school here? Mm-hmm. And we said, that's very interesting. We'll come back tomorrow. We'll let you know. So we went home, and we cracked open a bottle of wine, and we parked our kids in front of Dora the Explorer, and we started to sort of brainstorm about what it would take to make an entire neighborhood move back and re-embrace a failing Chicago public school en masse. And we came back the next day with our list, and Susan read it, and she said, well, let's get started, girls. It's going to be a really busy year. So we organized, and we went back to the park, and we put all of these mommies onto teams. Mm-hmm. We had infrastructure and PR and curriculum and marketing and enrichment and a special events team, and then all of those teams had to succeed concurrently to make the project work. You couldn't fix the library 1 year and then say, you know, in a couple,
right.
you know, in a couple months we'll, you know, figure out that enrichment piece or something. So,
right.
We figured we had 9 months to pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
And after 9 months, we had our first open house for the neighborhood, and 300 families came, and 78 kids signed up for preschool that day.
Mm-hmm.
So we got it off the ground, and then. Now, today, Nettlehurst is, you know, one of the most respected schools in Chicago. It has some of the highest test scores. It has, you know, a lot of really innovative programming, and it's full of neighborhood kids. So it really became much more than the sum of its parts.
How has bringing your child to that school compared to when you were growing up, say, during your time going to school? Was there a big contrast in terms of back then and of course, 9 years ago, and obviously now, in the present moment?
That's a really good question. You know, when I think of the kind of public education that I had, mm-hmm. I've had public and private and parochial and weird university mm-hmm. experiments and all sorts of stuff. But when you think about the kind of public school experience that most of us had as kids, most of us, you know, kind of went to a school that was more or less okay, and then we came home and had snack, kind of played with our friends, and sort of disappeared and showed up at dinner time. Like my mm-hmm. rule was, you had to be back when the street lights went on. And that world has changed an awful lot. But the idea, I think, the scarcity of spots and the whole frenetic mm-hmm. frenzy that surrounds trying to get your kid into school these days has us all believing that things have to be super spectacular in order to make a
right.
decent education, and that's not really true. But that said, the public school now where my kids are, Nettlehurst, I would put their education on par with any private school in the country. It really is that good. But one of the things that's really nice about it is, first of all, it's a really eclectic group of kids.
Mm-hmm.
It's diverse and interesting and quirky. But because all of these people who came in the initial wave with me were really risk-tolerant people,
mm-hmm.
and we were all actors and artists and yoga instructors and kind of fringy people who didn't have a lot to lose,
right.
the school has a really cool, vibrant, funkadelic, great vibe to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that energy has really been sustaining to making this project work, and it's made an environment that is way more than the sum of its parts. You know, it's just,
mm-hmm.
it's interesting and fabulous and fun, but it's also, I think, a stellar education too.
What I gather also is that there is tremendous amount of parents' involvement in the school
mm-hmm.
and a very supporting role as compared to maybe a lot of times parents may tend to come across from an adversarial standpoint of view, you know, like I'm
right.
watching you, so to speak. And whereas you guys came in and were able to really rally everyone around, tell us a little bit about that. How was the energy like in terms of rallying the parents and, of course, the school staff themselves?
Well, let's talk about community organizing first.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing that was so markedly different about our movement is that instead of just trying to galvanize the parents at the school, like, mm-hmm. which is how most theories of reform work. You know, how can we get more parents doing homework? How can we get more parents to the potluck dinner?
Mm-hmm.
We galvanized a neighborhood. We galvanized an entire community, whether people had kids or not, to wrap their arms around this little school and make it the heart of the community. So we turn to the energy of an entire community rather than just the few people who are already at the school. So that was the first thing that was really different.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is we could not have anticipated that beyond my little teeny tiny play lot, that there would be so many thousands of other people who needed this school to work just as badly as we did and would be willing to work to make it happen. We had no way of knowing that. And it's not like it was such a hard sell in the sense that everybody needed this school to succeed. Everybody needed an option. It's not like we were selling ho-hos or Twinkies. You know, people need schools to work.
Mm-hmm.
Your politicians want schools to work. Your businesses want to retain a family base. I mean, there are lots and lots of people who have a vested interest in having a neighborhood school succeed, and we harnessed that energy, that driving energy. So changing community perceptions was a very, very difficult job, but galvanizing that energy was actually in many ways much easier than we could have imagined. You know, people really do want to help. They really want to help public schools succeed, but they need to know what to do. So right now, everybody thinks that American education is so messed up that there isn't anything they possibly could do to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not true. There's tons of stuff people could do. They just need to know what's possible. One of the joys of needing everything is anything you get is perfect. So there isn't anything that anybody in my community did in life, whether they were a lawyer or a plumber or electrician or an artist or a painter or an accountant, didn't matter, whatever they did, we needed it. And we could find a way to channel that energy and expertise and talent into the school to make it work and make it succeed. So part of it is reaching out to people and asking for help. And then it's the second part is giving them things to do that aren't coming to your school and cleaning up your garbage. It's what do you do in life and how can you put a little bit of that towards the school? There are versions of me sitting around every sandbox in America. I am really not Joan of Arc. I am, you know, we were eight moms in a diner, and we were very normal moms. But we did not do this project by ourselves. Yes, we were the catalysts. Yes, we were the cheerleaders. But literally thousands and thousands of people have been involved in this project. I'll give you an example of sort of like reaching out to the universe, which is going to sound crazy, but it's the way this entire project worked. So a linen store had this great big oak counter in their store, and the store was going under, and so we asked if we could have it because we knew our librarian wanted a circulation desk, and they had it brought over with pro bono movers, and the guys came up and they said, you know, girls, this desk is never going to make it up the stairs. It weighs like 2 tons. There's just no way on earth it's going to take 10 men for sure to pull this up the stairs so you can go down and say goodbye to it.
Mm-hmm.
So we went downstairs to say goodbye to the circulation desk. And right outside the caribou that's next to the school were 10 men, and they're like, we'll help you, little ladies. And these 10 strangers hauled that beast up the stairs. Took them 2 hours in a full sweat. I have no idea who they were. Never saw them again, no idea. But they helped because there was an immediate need, and we called out to the universe, hey, we need help, and eventually somebody shows up to help. And seriously, when I tell you everything in this project worked about like that, it really was. And I think there's this sense that if you're on the right path and you're doing sort of what is good and noble and just sort of what you're supposed to be doing, then really goodness will come to you in some ways. You know, it's not all rainbows and sunshine, but
right,
if you're on the right path, things will work and people will join in your dream because it will be their dream too. You know, it's just a question of connecting all of those people together so that there's an energy that's moving forward together.
What were some of the major challenges that you encountered?
Oh, we had many, 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 many challenges. you know, it really wasn't all, you know, unicorns and sunshine. We walked into an extraordinarily toxic teaching environment. We had one teacher who had a restraining order against her for hitting students in a classroom. We had some teachers that muttered obscenities walking the hallways. You know, the school had test scores in the 30s. It was 100% free and reduced lunch. You know, we had all of the kids at the school were bussed in from overcrowded schools, not to satisfy any racial mandate. It's just that the neighborhood refused to come. We didn't displace any of those kids. All of those kids stayed at Nettlehurst. In fact, our 7th and 8th grade are still kids from overcrowded schools. But that was a challenge because we knew that for a decade we were certainly going to have, you know, a population that has more challenges than certainly the stable middle class neighborhood that I live in. And so we had a local school council in Chicago. All schools have these local school councils. Ours was mired in lawsuits and craziness and all kinds of Bananarama stuff. So that was really, really challenging. You know, but actually, you wouldn't believe, but the reality is the hardest part to fix, you know, there are ways to finagle books and supplies and there are ways to do all of that that are actually pretty easy. The hardest thing that we had to deal with was overcoming neighborhood perceptions. And that took up maybe 70% of our efforts. You know, if everybody thinks that a school is a disaster on stilts and all the messages they get from the media only reinforce that, and all of their own visual clues tells them that a school is not a suitable choice, and their parents are telling them, their friends are telling them, and, you know, you have a four-year-old. It's not like you're going to sell your kid down a river. Or, you know, so that was really a tough challenge to ask people to take a risk of faith and a leap of faith to say, look, if we are all holding hands together, we are going to be okay. You know, we'll be all right. You know, this is elementary school. This is not rocket science.
You mentioned just now about some teachers that are obviously really on board, as well as you have teachers that are not on board. How did that turn out? I mean, did they eventually turn around themselves?
You know, it was really interesting. We had a curriculum team of moms filled with educators and psychiatrists, psychologists, people who'd actually know what they were looking at. And they went to all the public, private, parochial schools we would have considered. They sat in on all the classes. They videotaped all of the teachers. And they came back basically happy, which was really good news, because had they come back and said, you know what, this place is fundamentally broken, we likely would have said, I hope your new library works for you, but this isn't going to work for us. But the most important thing that that team wanted, more than anything, was a guarantee from our principal that we could have a parent in the classroom every day. And Susan said, sure. We've learned now that that's kind of an anomaly, that that doesn't happen in many schools, public or private. But the effect of that was twofold. One, it helped mollify a really skittish population that, you know, somebody was minding the store. But it did something else. I think the PC way to put it is all of those parents sort of wandering the halls and poking into classes and stuff like that, the teachers that did not share our educational vision have since found suitable accommodation elsewhere. It was like turning on the lights. And the people who were not up for the new world order just decided to leave. And within the first 2 years of this movement, every single ineffective teacher left Nettlehurst voluntarily on their own and in one fell swoop. And that happened far more quickly than we ever could have anticipated. And Susan let us sit in on every hiring decision that was made at the school. And so now, you know, seriously, this whole group of teachers, they are so talented and so committed. They're there till late in the evening every night. They're there on weekends. They're there on the summers. It's phenomenal. And they're really amazingly committed, brilliant, brilliant people. And when the most disruptive forces left, it made the space possible to really bring out greatness in these teachers. But Nettlehurst is a regular old neighborhood school. There's no selective enrollment. There's no gifted program. There's no tracking. There's none of that stuff. And we have a union and all that stuff that, you know, every neighborhood school has. And we have shown that you can take garden variety normal, and if you roll up your sleeves and sort of put some love and affection and hard work into it, you can have a school that outperforms charters, that outperforms selective enrollment schools, and outperforms some of the private schools too. Because schools aren't anything more than a collection of adults trying to do right by kids. That's it. And people who tell you that there's something different are just, you know, that's just a lot of noise. It's not true. That's that's all it is. So if we all have basically the same raw materials to deal with, surely it's within our control as communities to fix what's in our own backyard. And if everybody just fixed what was in their own backyard, we would see real systemic change in this country.
One of the things I gather as well is patience that everyone has to have, because this project, I mean, we talk about it being overnight, but it's certainly a process. And before you know it, 1, 2, 3, 4 years that goes by. And then, of course, once you get to a certain level of a turning point, then sustaining that. So tell us a little bit about how long did it actually take to get, say, beyond the 25 percentile, 50, and then to a point whereby you think your movement have really made the turn?
Okay, well, I got to tell you, patience is not one of my virtues. and we didn't have time. We just didn't have it. We knew we needed a school that worked. And we had a time frame of 9 months. That's all the time we had, because we all had four-year-olds. So if we didn't come up with a viable option within a year.
You guys are gone, you guys are gone.
Everybody's gone. The energy in the park would dissipate, and then that would be the end of that. So we didn't have time, and we didn't have patience, and we didn't have anything other than sprint. That was the only thing we had. Everybody just worked like gangbusters, and we didn't have patience, and we didn't have we were too green to know what we were up against. We were too green to know when people said no, we only heard not yet. Not through the front door. Come in through the window. You're supposed to come in through the basement. You're supposed to come back when I'm not home. You know, that's all we heard. We never heard no. So certainly there's a level of, entitlement that comes with that kind of attitude that thinks that public schools are supposed to work for you and thinks that your politicians are supposed to work for you and stuff like that. And that's a reasonable criticism that, yes, we were entitled. We believed, we certainly believed it was our right to have a neighborhood school that worked for us, for sure. But the flip side of that is, instead of walking in and starting to shriek at people about how everything was wrong and somebody else was going to have to fix it, we were willing to roll up the sleeves and say, how are we going to fix this with you? How are we going to help you fix this place? Because it's got to get fixed, and it's got to get fixed fast.
Right.
A lot of things happened over the course of various points in this movement. You know, now we're 8 years in, right? So I think after our first open house, after 9 months, when those 78 kids signed up, that was a huge milestone. When we painted every last little drop of this school. There isn't an inch of the school that hasn't been licked by a neighborhood artist. And if people go on YouTube and put in how to walk to school /Nettlehurst, there's two videos up that show people the interior. And that didn't happen overnight. I mean, that really was a process that's even still ongoing. But there were certain points where certain really amazing projects happened, and we thought, you know, if we made Atlantis out of this basement, surely we can make this work. We became one of Chicago's first inaugural community schools, which means we turned it into a community school in the afternoon. And when we won a grant that would give us some of the seed money to make that happen, we thought, oh, this is really a turning point. So there were lots of points which were huge moments for us, and there were lots of steps backwards too, but really this was just baby steps, very quick baby steps, but baby steps, one in front of another, in front of another, in front of another. The entire project didn't happen overnight in that we didn't even start fundraising in earnest until 4 years into this movement. So we did this whole project on a budget of nothing, dumpster diving and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, 6 years later, we have a partnership, a $200,000 partnership with the Blackhawks and a Nate Berkus teaching kitchen. And somebody might look at all of that stuff and think that that just happened or dropped from the sky from the beginning. It didn't. It was a process that took years and years and years. But one of the problems, though, with now having all this fabulous stuff at the end, 8 years in, is someone might look at Nate Berkus's really fabulous teaching kitchen that he made for us and look at the stainless steel appliances and the beautiful subway tiles and think that the stuff is what matters, that that end result is what matters. The stuff doesn't matter. The stuff is inconsequential. The only thing that mattered was engagement, and that's something we had within a year's time. And the kitchen that Nate replaced, the one that we built, community volunteers built out of dumpsters, was just as valuable and just as important because we were embedding teaching into a curriculum and we needed a place where moms could and dads could hang out and have a cup of coffee and watch their kids play with a mead table and talk about stuff. So the kitchen that it replaced was just as valuable because engagement is the only thing that matters. The end result of what it looks like is just, you know, that's just a lot of window dressing, and that's not to say that that stuff isn't nice and that can make a huge difference. Of course it does. But engagement is what matters.
Very true. You talk about fundraising just now, and of course you didn't get into it till about 4 years later, but in the very beginning I'm sure that's a very difficult process in the sense that you guys are pretty much in the middle-class neighborhood, and a lot of things that needed to get done. So obviously there were a lot of communication going on between you and everyone else. Any time did any of the parents themselves got disheartened and say just left the project and say, you know, this is too difficult?
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, first let me hit the first part about fundraising, then we took to talk about the internal stuff.
Yeah.
In terms of fundraising, we had a fundraising team on it, and we disbanded that fundraising team in the first 4 weeks. We realized that nobody wanted to give money to a failing Chicago public school, and the parents in the park didn't want to get shaken down either because they were investing too much of their own sweat equity in the project. So we really did this project on a budget of nothing. We just asked people to donate a little bit of whatever it is they had. So we did this gallon of paint by gallon of paint. We asked painters if they could just adopt one classroom, one hallway, just one.
Right.
We'd get 4 gallons of paint donated, and we would show up with donuts and cheerlead. And we knocked this project out room by room, hallway by hallway. And then we asked artists to come and paint, and we said, you can paint anything you want. You know, just don't make it scary.
Right.
Don't make it phallic. Don't paint the face of Jesus. Other than that, do whatever you want, right? It's a big, ugly school. Fix it.
Right.
So we really did this piecemeal, 1 foot in front of another, and the fundraising stuff, the fancy fundraising stuff, really didn't happen until 4 or 5 years in when we got some new parents in who really took it upon themselves to figure out how the fundraising racket works. And they're winners in this game and losers in terms of public schools being asked to self-finance, which all public schools are across the country. And there's a chapter in the book all about the things we learned about how to do it. And, you know, it's a huge discussion about how unfair that is and all the rest of it. But to the extent that schools are being asked to self-finance, it behooves public schools to figure out how that works, because big sales are not going to cut it anymore for this stuff. That said, like the fancy stuff thing that I was just talking about, money is not the answer. It just, it helps. I'm not saying no to money. Money's great.
But
money is not the it's not just a question that schools need more money. Obviously they do, but you can do a whole lot with very, very, very little. And so money is really not the answer. You can take all the money in the world, but if a school is not in a position to receive it or spend it wisely, then it's almost meaningless. So it's the answer is engagement. And in terms of the personal dynamics of this project, when I tell you we were really pulling straws in the park to see who was going to actually send their kids when push came to shove, it was emotional and it was hard and it was painful, because especially for all of us who had invested so much work in this project and knew about all the skeletons and knew what we were up against, it was a really hard sell, because, you know, people who have little kids are understandably very nervous about what's okay and what they're going to tolerate and what they want. And politics are very different when they come home, you know? So it was hard, and we saw every defection as, you know, a knife in the heart, and we thought every defection spelled doom. But, you know, I think there were enough of us that were drinking the punch that we just, it was just by sheer will that we thought we have to make this work. We just have to. And we saw enough signs that seemed promising, really promising. I mean, we had a principal who believed in us and treated us like grown-ups. And, you know, the teachers certainly showed enough signs, even from the beginning, that if they could stop getting rocks thrown at them, then they would be, you know, great. And we just felt like if we were holding hands together that we would make it work. But it was hard. It was really hard. And it's hard to be involved. I mean, for me personally, on a personal note, it is hard to be involved in a project that you don't know is going to succeed. You know? It's not a traditional, it wasn't a traditional philanthropy thing where, you know, you walk in and then you're doing the spring, you know, gala, or, you know, some other, hey, we're just doing the walkathon for whatever. You know, this was kind of a really kooky project, because can you fix the public school? Is that doable? I don't know. But we all kept sort of saying, it's just so crazy, it just might work. So, yeah, I mean, it was hard, though. Personally, it takes a toll, and every time kids, your own children, are involved in the mix, everything gets ratcheted up, because now it's personal, and that's and that's hard too. So for all of us core members of the project, it was also very personal, and you know, so tough, but doable. You know, it's all doable.
One of the things you talked about that I've heard is the fact that your approach is changing the climate of the school, and then you change the entire community. In this case, you change the attitude of the people that surrounds the school. So having said that, that's a totally different approach, because a lot of times we're coming in from outside in, especially in this kind of situation, and you're trying to force something out of something. You guys work backwards, so that's quite interesting.
You know, look, turnaround schools, charter schools, there's no question those are easier to get right. It's easier to start from scratch than try to fix what you have. I think we had this attitude, which is, I don't know, it's kind of, I guess it was, we were too green to know that other people didn't have it, but the idea is we just assumed that everybody at the school was doing the best they can. You know, the parents were as involved as they could be, and they were doing the best jobs that they could, and the students who were there were probably doing the best jobs they could, and Susan was probably doing the best job she could. But the idea is principals are being asked to do a whole bunch of stuff, and what we said to Susan is, look, run a school, run it well. You don't need to be a party planner. You don't need to be a community organizer. You don't need to be a fundraiser. You don't need to be an accountant. You don't have to be any of those things. We will help you. We will galvanize a community to help you take on all of those pieces. And Susan was self-assured enough to say, hey, listen, I am not a marketing whiz. If you guys think that there are people in this community who know how to market and can help us figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
Let's reach out and see what we can come up with. And even those of us in the core movement, I mean, we also said, hey, look, you know, you'd say to people, let's say our marketing captain, she'd say, well, I'll help, but what is it you want me to do? And you'd say, well, there's no website. The school has no marketing materials. If anybody mm-hmm. was even remotely interested, there would be nothing to give them. There's clearly a marketing problem. You have a very skittish neighborhood, and everybody thinks that public schools are terrible. So there is a problem. Go figure it out and fix it. And she'd say, but how? And you'd say, I don't know. Go figure it out, fix it, and yeah. report back in 2 weeks. Tell us how you're doing. And, you know, gather up as many people who could help you do that. So we had team captains. And those team captains were just charged with fixing that enormous problem. So mm-hmm. you've got an infrastructure that needs fixing, fix it. You know, you have
right.
you have to bring in after-school enrichment. I don't know how you're going to do it. Fix it. you know, mm-hmm. somebody's got to, you know, buck up the act. Fix it. Whatever it was just, I don't know what's wrong. Clearly there's a lot wrong, or maybe there isn't, but whatever it is, I don't know. You're a genius. Go fix it. And then those captains would say, all right, well, I'm clearly not going to do this all by myself because that's crazy. How mm-hmm. many people can I gather up? And you didn't need thousands. You just needed a couple friends who
right.
knew what they were doing to say, okay, let's really think this through. What's the problem? And take the marketing piece, for example. You can rebrand and reposition a failing Chicago public school as easy as cereal.
Mm-hmm.
Who knew? But you can. But you've got to figure out how to do that. And that's why we wrote the book, because the criticism that we had, you know, a lot of social capital in that park to figure this stuff out really is valid. You know, look, we learned, and it was a steep curve, and we reached out to a lot of smart people to help us figure out how to do it. And we wrote the book so that reformers sitting around sandboxes all over the country
mm-hmm.
would have an easier time of it. And that's not to say it's a one-size-fits-all model or that we have all the answers. It really is a old-school, grassroots, customizable, nonpartisan, old-school solution. So take what works, adapt it to your own neighborhood, your own community, your own school, and hopefully it can be informative in some way to help people make change in their communities from the ground up.
Your message has a universal appeal, especially to all parents. What would you like your readers to get out of reading your book?
I hope the biggest thing is that the fate of public school is really not beyond our control. We've been told for a long time that it's really, really bad and we can't fix it. And unless you're Mark Zuckerberg with $1 million or, you know, Jeffrey Canada mm-hmm. and able to, mm-hmm. you know, make entire zones out of Harlem,
mm-hmm.
that there isn't anything that normal people could do. And that's just not true. There's so much that we could do if people knew what was possible. So I hope that the biggest message of the book, whether people read it or not or whatever, is that people gather up 8 friends, a couple friends, walk into their neighborhood school, sit down with the principal, and say, hi, we're here to help. What are your dreams for this place? How can we help you achieve your vision? How can we help you mobilize an army in this neighborhood to make this school what you dream it can be? And hopefully your dream of what it can be is what we dream it can be too. Because, look, there's plenty of blame to go around for the state of mm-hmm. public schooling. You know, there's
yeah.
ample amount of blame. And really just pointing fingers and shouting, while it can solve a couple problems here and there, it's not going to solve the problem system-wide. And the neighborhood school model succeeded in this country for 100 years. Every single urban area in America is based on the neighborhood school model. So the idea that that model is inherently flawed, you know, I have a hard time wrapping my mind around that. But neighborhood schools worked for 100 years because communities were invested in them. They were the heart mm-hmm. of the community. And we lost that a little bit in the last 30 years for a lot of reasons that make sense, but we lost it. So I think that if we can return to that kind of homespun idea, which is not hard to do since it's virtually free, and that energy that we have is in ample supply, even in neighborhoods where people least expect it, I think we could bring about real change. And, you know, sometimes we get this criticism that says, oh, well, you could do what you did because you're in East Lakeview, you're in Boys Town in Chicago, and there's, you know, middle class, stable middle class neighborhood, middle class people. Well, sure, you could do it, but it can't help happen in disadvantaged neighborhoods or neighborhoods where there's less social capital and stuff.
Right.
And in Chicago, there's a group of moms in a Pilsen, which is a Hispanic neighborhood, who staged a sit-in in their school field house that the board was threatening to tear down. And the moms first just wanted to save the field house, but then they thought, you know, we're actually going to build a library. Not only do we have overcrowding, but we would like a library. And how come our school doesn't have a library? That's ridiculous. And these moms, this just happened this year, these moms staged a sleep-in for close to a month. And guess what? Now they have a library. Why? Because hundreds of books started pouring in. And Architects for Humanity came in and said, we'll help you build it. And the board said, all right, I guess this is a neighborhood that really, really wants it, and we'll back down too, and the police department backed down, and all the rest of it. And the reality is those Whittier moms who took over that field house at that school had the same energy and the same interest that we moms had. It is the same thing. I have yet to meet a mom who did not want what was best for her kid. I have yet to meet a mom who would not walk through Kohl's for her kid. She may make different choices. She might not be able to articulate it. But everybody wants to do right by their kids if they can. So if it is possible to harness that energy and that energy of a community that wants a community to succeed and stakeholders in a community that want a neighborhood school to succeed, then I think change is possible even in places where people believe it's not.
To me, that's the use of the power of unconditional love at its best. That's what you were talking about.
Well, you know, look, I don't love children. I mean, I love my children, right? But it's not like we were some altruistic, you know, Mother Teresa's. We weren't.
Yeah.
We were all very self-interested. We needed a school for our kids, and we needed it in short order. And we knew that if we could create a school that was good enough for our kids, it would also be good enough for everybody else's kids. Now, is that kind of arrogant? Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, we can have a fight about whether somebody thinks the Joffrey or ABT is a better ballet company, but I'll take anybody to the mat to say that every kid should be exposed to dance and theater and art and music and sports and foreign language and science. And, like, duh, every kid should have that. Every kid in America should have that.
Right.
So we were arrogant to believe that our kids and everybody else's kids deserved the very best. Really, they did. And so there was this self-interest that we were able to channel. You know, we didn't expect that everybody was running a philanthropy. We had businesses come in and help, and we helped try to give them PR and recognition and all the other stuff that they need, because the reality is people are not, you know, totally altruistic actors. They need to see returns on their investment. They need to see worth and a local project like this really does benefit people locally. So we weren't trying to fix the entire garbage barge of education. We were just trying to fix our little piece of it. And while somebody could, you know, I guess rightly say, like, yeah, but what about the rest of the, what about everybody else? The answer is, yes, that's right. What about everybody else? And that's a problem, too. But to the extent that we can hopefully inspire people to turn and fix their own little corner of the world, then collectively we could see great change, right? I hope we could. I think we could. Mm-hmm. It's certainly happening all over Chicago. We're not the only example. There are lots and lots of examples of neighborhood schools that are on the move. Some are succeeding with our help, without our help. And mm-hmm. I've been touring the country, and I can tell you that there are examples of our movement that are happening all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing. And they have the same issues and the same problems. The people on the ground are different, and the stakeholders are different, and you know, different things are different in different communities. But there are these moms with their little spiral notebooks saying,
mm-hmm.
"All right, first we're going to knock this, then we're going to knock that, then we're going to do that." You know, it's all very, very surprisingly similar.
What is about taking back your neighborhood, basically in this case, from the educational standpoint of view, and is taking ownership.
It is.
If you can do that, then there's no reason why things will not turn around, because it is your neighborhood. If you have enough pride in living in your neighborhood and you want it to be recognized for excellence, then you can do something about it. Where can someone get more information about you and buy your book?
Well, my website is howtowalktoschool.com. So everything is there, including videos and pictures and interviews and stuff like that. That's all on the website, howtowalktoschool.com. The book is in most bookstores across the country. You can get it on Amazon. It's on Kindle. It's coming out in paperback this summer. So the book is there. Most libraries in the country have it. It's been pretty well received. So it's in almost every library in the country. And, you know, ideally what would be really great is if people bought a book and put it in their school libraries so that more people could have access to it. Like, that would be super duper. But, you know, I think that we have a very, in some ways, a short window of opportunity here to knock out a national movement.
Mm-hmm.
With Waiting for Superman and Race to Nowhere and Lunchline and a lot of other movies that are out right now, people are talking about school reform in a way that's more serious than they have in decades.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the administration is certainly on the same page, and a lot of, with Arne Duncan in office as the Secretary of Education, there's just this tremendous opportunity for this kind of movement to take hold. So if your listeners can help by sparking this revolution, that would be phenomenal. If I blog about education reform on the Huffington Post. So if people go on to HuffPo and put in Edelberg, they can become a fan on Huffington Post. It's also on Facebook. It's on Twitter. And if people can help spread the word
mm-hmm.
about the book and about our movement, that would be enormously helpful because, like, for example, Michelle Obama is not planting a garden on the White House lawn because she likes to garden. I mean, she might, but she's from Chicago. She's a Chicago girl. So
mm-hmm.
She's doing it because a movement has taken hold, a really simple, honest, decent idea took hold that, hey, look, we could be growing our own stuff and we can be interested in nutrition and obesity, you know, combating obesity and stuff like that. And it's a simple idea that took hold that people thought, hey, I personally could help. I
mm-hmm.
personally could be part of the solution. So if that same grassroots movement could take hold with education, where people thought, hey, you know what, I thought it was a really beyond my control kind of thing, but maybe actually there is something that I could do. Maybe actually I could go on Donors Choose and, you know, just invest in a classroom that's in my neighborhood, a classroom project, or maybe I could gather up some friends and just walk in and see what I could do.
Mm-hmm.
Then I think we could pull out a national movement at this time and we could see a real revolution in this country, which would be totally, totally great.
Very true. And I do want to mention a few things here. The Library Journal said it is a must read for all parents and teachers about your book. And you mentioned something about Arne Duncan, the former superintendent of Chicago Public School. He did the foreword on your book. He was
mm-hmm.
very impressed with what you guys were doing. And, of course, the current mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, did an afterword. So your book is very well received, the things that you guys are standing for as far as public education is concerned. How has writing this book impacted you personally?
You know, that's a really great question. You know, I didn't set out to be some kind of lunatic public school reformer or writer. I'm an artist mostly. And so it's kind of goofy, but I wouldn't have done this project if it didn't feed me intellectually. And the education that I've had doing this project over the last 8 years has been the most interesting ride and the most informative education that I could imagine. So for me, since I have a background in political science and I'm also an artist, mm-hmm. this was this crazy good public, you know, political science thing. It was just a crazy real-life study of a lot of things that I had been studying for years and years and years about community organizing and leveraging resources. And, you know, one of the things we did was we brought in a farmer's market with Bensadon USA, mm-hmm. and trying to get a farmer's market off the ground was, you know, a three-month project that sort of took over my whole life. But fascinating to figure out, you know, it had me talking to people who are, community development people, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. architects and all kinds of interesting stuff. And so this project fed me professionally. And then it also, you know, here's one of the secrets about child rearing that I don't know, probably most of your readers can relate, you know, listeners can relate to, is that, you know, it's actually kind of tedious and mm-hmm. kind of alienating. And mm-hmm. there's lots of parts, even if you love your kids and are really happy staying at home with them, there are parts of it that are kind of lonely. And so for me, it put me in touch with a group of people that are now my very best friends. Mm-hmm. And doing this project and being able to paint while our little kids played around us and to have people to connect with and talk to, just emotionally was so satisfying, because people in cities, you know, we need a good barn raising just as much as anybody else. Mm-hmm. And so for us to come together in the service of something that was fun and quirky and joyful, although at times it was hard and sad and frustrating, but mostly joyful and exhilarating and interesting, really, really interesting, personally was a great, you know, just a really, really great experience. And I am so, so very grateful to have been in the company of the people I've been in company with for the last 8 years. It really has been my honor and privilege to have been working with them. And, you know, it's a funny thought when I say that schools aren't anything more than grown-ups doing right by kids. Mm-hmm. I think that if we took the group of parents that are sitting at the school now and dropped us all on an island so long as, you know, somebody made us still, mm-hmm. you know, I think our huts would be really fabulous and it would be fun. It would be a good, it would be a perfectly fine island to be shipwrecked on. And I'll give you an example of what the kind of community we were able to make. One of our moms last mm-hmm. year came down with breast cancer, and that mom did not make dinner for herself for an entire year. Every single day, another family brought dinner and put it in the fridge, and her kid brought it home for a year. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where that happens outside of small-town America or in churches or in synagogues or something, but to have a school community that has so, I don't know, transformed or evolved or become mm-hmm. whatever goofy thing it is, that it takes that kind of care and love and interest in each other. I don't know. I'm so lucky to be mm-hmm. a part of this wave of energy. It really has been my pleasure.
And what's interesting also you talk about is that we're not talking about ABCs now. We're talking about social education trickling
right.
up from the children to the parents and the parents downwards, because when it's all said and done, you're making a better community
yeah.
for everyone.
Right, and that's the thing that's so interesting. People talk about schools sometimes, particularly when they talk about test scores and stuff like mm-hmm. that, mm-hmm. and they lose sight of the fact, in some ways, I don't want to say that school is the least important part of the equation, but it's just one part of the equation.
Right.
In the life of a child, it's all of it, and in the life of your family, it's all of it. It's walking to school and having snack and having sleepovers and having play dates and having people you can talk to and having a kid that learns how to read but also learns how to, you know, dance and play guitar and do science experiments and all of that kind of stuff. It's life. It's training kids for life and creating a neighborhood where adults are just as happy to be part of this experience as everything else. And so that's why the neighborhood school model is so important, because you cannot keep a creative class in your city if you don't have a neighborhood schools that work. Every neighborhood, when you look around the country at successful neighborhoods, neighborhoods that are vibrant, where people want to live there, what do they have? They usually have a farmer's market. They have a decent bar. They probably have a decent bistro-type place where somebody could get a decent meal with some good bread. They're near some kind of public transportation, and there is affordable housing of some sort where you can afford to live there. And that's what. And there's a neighborhood school that works where people have guaranteed admission. That's what makes interesting, vibrant, healthy neighborhoods, suburban or urban. And so if cities are serious about keeping a creative class, you have to have neighborhood schools that work. If you want to retain property values and all of that sort of stuff, it's just a no-brainer. But for some reason, that's kind of gotten left
lost.
But I think the reason why it got lost is everybody's under this assumption that there isn't anything they could do to make it work. Either schools are good or schools are bad, and that's that, you know?
Right. Very true. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
A recipe for living. You know, there's so many great recipes for living beyond just having, like, good bread and cheese and a bottle of wine in your refrigerator at all times and a decent bar of chocolate. But, you know, as sort of like your baseline, seems like a good recipe. But I think the most important one for our project and what we were able to do is a notion that if you roll up your sleeves with a little sweat and moxie and creativity and charm, and certainly a tremendous amount of will and positive energy, that we can collectively move mountains. And that is possible. And you don't have to do it all by yourself, that people really will come together to help you. But people have to have channels to make that happen. You have to create a space for people to be able to help a vision succeed. And that initial spark, really isn't much. But in the service of doing what is right and just and noble and good and all of that good stuff that we all know, people will come together to help. But it's a question of channeling that energy. And it's easy sometimes when you look at our world and you look at all the stuff that's wrong with it, and it's, you know, there's garbage floating around the planet and war and genocide and all that terrible plastic bags and tons of stuff that's wrong. But, you know, Simple, all of those gestures that make the world better are all add up collectively to do great things. And in service of our kids and our families and certainly ourselves, we can make the world, in many ways, what we want it to be if we're willing to work hard to make it happen.
That's fantastic. Jacqueline, that's a great recipe for living. Thank you for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning as we continue with our 2011 Mother's Day series. My guest will be Jennifer Cavallo. Inspired by her mom, Jennifer, now a mother of two, wrote an award-winning baby journal titled My Life, A Chronicle of the Journey. This baby journal provides you the opportunity to become your child's own biographer. Each chapter of your child's story begins with a special message that helps frame entries by inspiring you to record all the special moments in your child's life, making them personal and meaningful. Jennifer and I will be discussing her life's journey, her her award-winning baby journal, and her new children's book titled Frittabello and His Angels. For additional information about this show, future shows, and to receive a free recipe for living, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening and have a great week. Jacqueline, thank you again and have a happy Mother's Day.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's a pleasure being on your show. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.